So I wanted to start this week, as I did last week, with coming outside of just the particular skills, just with just some general idea of parenting. When you think of our parenting, out of the following two models, we could either think of our children as clay in the hands of an artist, of a potter, someone who's forming it, or as seeds in the hands of a farmer. Which one of those two parables would we consider to be the more accurate parable for our molding the lives of our children?
Seeds.
We're all in agreement, right? Definitely seeds. Because it's certainly not just clay molding in the hands of an artist molding the clay, because that would mean that it's entirely up to the hands of the artist in terms of the way that you form it. The clay has no opinions of its own. The clay is just entirely being shaped by the one who molds it. So it's certainly not going to be a valving. It's going to be seeds. The trick with the example, when we think about our children as seeds, is that we actually don't know what kind of seeds we have. I was making fun of everybody, no one wanted to sit next to me, so to make you comfortable, I will. The trick is we have seeds that we're given, that are our responsibility to grow, but we actually don't know what kind of seed we have. Which is an important thought to keep in mind, that as I'm saying this, I'm sure you all know this to be true, but as our children grow and develop, it's actually not so simple to keep in mind that very often we think that we want to have an apple tree. And we're convinced we're going to have an apple tree because we are apple trees. And lo and behold, we got a cucumber. And we begin to treat it like an apple tree, and we expect it to be an apple tree and to grow big and tall and strong and produce apples, and it's just growing cucumbers. And it's an important thing to note that as much as we are responsible for shaping and molding and directing and training, we don't even really know the type of seed that we have. And especially as our families grow and we have multiple seeds, and we're an apple and we married an orange tree, and then we get a cucumber and a tomato, and we don't know anything about cucumbers and tomatoes. We were really hoping for an apple tree like ourselves, or an orange tree at least. It's a skill to be able to learn to know what environment, what we are responsible for, the environment in which those seeds grow. We are able to manage that. Some need more light than others. Others need more water than others. Others need to be inside. Some need to be outside. And to be able to always remember and note as we are raising and growing and shaping that fact, that they are different. They're different than us. Moshe Weinberger, who's a Rav in New York, likes to describe the adoption process. Anyone who knows anybody who's been through the adoption process, it's a grueling process. The social workers are like in charge of this little child, and because they are in charge of this child, they will grill the potential parents. They will go through all of their information, all of their facts, applications, that the documents that are necessary to be able to adopt the child are enormous, and the references and the interview, they run a whole battery of psychological tests, all in order to be able to raise this child for us, these social workers, to be able to give you this child. It's not a simple process. And you have to pass and prove that you're capable of doing so. So they used to say, this Moshe Weinberger, that don't think that God is any less thorough than an adoption agency. He also puts you through a battery of tests, and when he sends a child your way, it's specific. It's not just the next child in line. Like if each parent wants to have a child, and there's this row of souls waiting to be born as, you know, next. And this is the one that I got. And you say, oh, man, if I had that child, I'd be a really good parent. But never, I got this one. I don't know how to handle this one. This one drives me crazy. I just wish I could have that. And each parent looks at the other one's children and says, I would really be really good at that one. But it's not by chance, and it's not just that it happens to be. Out of the entire population of the world, he specifically chose and matched each child with each parent because he believes that each one of us has the skill sets necessary for that particular child. In the particular child it is, despite the fact that we often maybe would have wanted an apple tree, an orange tree, and we got a tomato. But he knows that that's what it is that we need. And it's just I always like to, in these opportunities, these little forums which we discuss parenting, to remind ourselves of those facts, which we all know, but are so hard to come to grips with when we were so sure that we were going to have something different. And I also just want to mention, for those with multiple children, it's very common that a parent has a more natural connection with certain children more than others. Because of the fact that we are our own species of tree, we married a specific species of tree, well, sometimes if a person has a family, it turns out that one or two of your children are actually the same type as you are. And there's a very natural connection. You just connect on a different level, more naturally, with that child than you do with some of the others. You don't love them any differently. You just connect differently. It's just a fact of life. It's just the nature of how things go. And it's something to be aware of as we go through that. That doesn't mean that you love the child any differently and you treat them all the same, even though despite the fact that there is that idea that an apple tree will obviously connect more naturally with another apple tree than the others. But it's out there. That's part of what we spoke about last week, the us having to grow as part of this parenting, not just raising a child, but our own growth as well. One last thought on that, in fact, is we have these gifts. It's important to tell our children that they are the greatest gifts that we have. It should be, they should hear that from us all the time, that you are a gift, and you should speak to your children. What is, my children hear it regularly from us, what's the greatest gift that Hashem gave me? And they know already, they think it's a joke, but it's important for them to hear that over and over. I am. They can mouth the word, I am the greatest gift. And then who else? And they'll list all the other children that they know that we view them as gifts that we were given. That you are the gift that I have, and you are the greatest gift. And I have 5 greatest gifts. And each one of them will rattle off the other 4 children when I ask them, what was the greatest gift? What's the greatest gift that I have that Hashem gave me? That they should sense that we were given this gift, and that they're a treat that we have to risk. Okay, let's get back. So this past week, how did it go? For those who were here last week and those who listened in, some initial feedback. Start with the jokes because I know I already got them from you, so I feel confident.
It's been amazing. It's actually like changed our entire relationship with our son. Daughter, not so much. She's just defiant, but she's also only 2.
I was going to say, she's a little young to really get it.
But Jordan,
Jordan.
I mean, we've tried. Like, we're not perfect, and it's not like we all of a sudden.
Wait,
can
you did it a whole hour and you're not perfect yet?
No. But, I mean, you can even ask your wife. She heard me on the phone at one point, actually using the tools. And, Kayla, crayons aren't meant for writing on doors. I mean, it's been crazy. It's really, he gets it. And he just turned 4. And, I mean, dinner is a completely different experience for us. We explained. Plate's going down at dinner. And we want you to eat with us, and if you get up,
dinner's over.
And a couple times we took away the plate, and he started, crying. I didn't understand the rule. Explain it again, type of thing. So, we put it back. But now, it's been a week, and tonight he knew dinner, and he catches himself. He starts to get off the chair, and then he slides back off. I was trying to
guilty look on his
face. So, I mean, it's really, it's really been, in the little places that we've implemented it, it's really been incredible.
Excellent. Any other just comments, things that worked, didn't work, tried it, didn't bother trying?
I feel, maybe I don't know what I'm doing, but I felt like it was making things harder for me.
Okay, yeah,
I just feel like when I tried join something, then I didn't know how to react to their reaction.
Yeah, do you have an example? This is important. Do you have an example?
Getting my daughter into the car after school. That's we try to go in the car, she runs into the parking lot, whatever. So I said, if you go into the car, we could get a treat or we could go for ice cream. So of course she did not. She ran, and then I said, we're not going to be able to get ice cream. And she was screaming, which I could, we could handle her screaming, but all day, crying. And I said, you next time, but I guess if I think back, the next day she actually ran to her car.
Oh, okay.
But I said that initial.
Yeah, what did you do?
We tried doing it a couple of times also in the house. That initial. How do you deal with that?
So she will yell and scream.
All day.
Right.
All day.
So then you go into what we spoke about last week of, you can yell and scream. I can't control whether or not my child yells or screams. I can only control where they'll yell or scream.
Right.
So. You want to go yell and scream in your room? I'm happy to take you, and you could spend as much time as you like there. And when you're ready to come back out and join us, we'll be so excited to have you. Did you try that?
Did we?
I told her she has to go to the room.
The catch room? How did that work?
I think it works good.
But I feel like only if you, it works if you actually take them there.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you can't send them. You need to pick them up. I mean, that's why you start when there's
sometimes
like
steps.
Right, and that probably doesn't work very well. I mean, if you pick them up and you bring them into the room, and then that, so that had some sense of a semblance of a success, at least.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. enough that she says, that's the crutch room now.
I think every home should have a crutch room. I'm a big believer in homes having a crutch room. When there's something going on, it's just strange to the crutch room and let them, give them the freedom and the choice, the that it's in their control to fetch when they want, how they want. You just decide where it will be.
It works well on your staff also.
I didn't listen to the audience, but Helen did, and not only did it work really, really well on our daughter, but I'm pretty sure it worked well on me.
I used to know one of my patients. Yeah, you can't have morphine because your urine is positive for cocaine. I would love to give you morphine, but we can't.
Did he get off the drugs there?
I don't know.
We'll see what happens.
A little bit harder than it is. It's tough age before.
Yeah.
What do you do when you say, okay, you're going to the catch room, and they say, yeah, right, and run away from you, and even if you pick them up and you put them in the room, they come right back out and they're not going in there?
Alright, so then it begins, everything gets up the step in terms of when they, and a good child that's worth keeping will continuously bump up the stakes.
There's no care for
timeout. This stage is where the most difficult part of the program is coming up with a creative consequence for the fact that you keep being defined and it keeps taking up more and more of my time and energy.
I do natural consequences of what it is, which usually leads to some sort of crying, which leads to mommy doesn't want you to be in here. You need to go and spend time in your room until you're ready to come out. And she says no. And then
she says no, meaning she comes out?
No, it says no, I don't want to go in.
She's younger, you could pick her up.
I pick her up and I put her in and she comes right back out.
So when she comes out that first time, and you put it in when you're ready to make it that she is allowed. First,
no, it's true. It's always
when you're ready to come out.
When you're ready to come out, and when you're ready to stop crying, so she comes back out crying, saying, I don't want to stay in there.
Are you able to stay with her, or you have to? I mean, you can't even do that.
No, I could go back in there and stay with her.
I mean, that's what I would do.
After the second
child. No, it's a totally different story. That's what it would be, and then and there would be a point though. Where I would not do that, I would then just leave, and then it's a matter of, I'm so sorry that you've made the decision to come back out when you're still touching.
And that's then, usually when I put myself in
time out. Right, you could do that also. In terms of where you just remove yourself from the scene. But what I have often found when the kids are not, when they get to find where I'm not no longer going to chase them around the house or fight with them, is I'm so sorry that you've decided to deal with it this way. I'll have to figure out what to do. And they, in the book, in Love and Logic books, they state all the time, you can stall all you want as a parent for time. So I'm going to have to talk to Daddy about this. I'm not really sure how we're going to handle this. Don't you worry about it. We'll figure it out. Anyway, most kids really don't like that. When they're old enough to be at the stage where they're that defiant, and you say, totally fine, that's not my problem, Daddy and I will talk about how to handle this later. It's just, and then you're really just stalling for time. Because I don't know what I'm going to do. How do I figure out what the... I don't know. But
other than that, so it's really great for toothbrushing.
Great. Yeah, that's my favorite one. They learned that real fast.
We ran into a little problem with the bathtub. It was working really well with the natural conquest. We were making great progress.
Yeah.
And then there was bath time where she did not want to go in the bath.
Okay.
So, okay, you'll have to wear dirty pajamas. Okay. And she said, okay, I'm just not going to wear anything. And so she was just, and I said, Daniela, it's time for a bath. I'm going to wear your pajamas. Or, and she starts running around the room, she folds out the door. I'm like, okay, well then, you're making the decision. You don't want to do that. It's not laying out time anymore, so you can stay in your room. I walk out.
Are you okay with that?
Well, I mean, I was, but 15 minutes later, she was lying around in her underwear, in her bed, singing, it's a cover of mine, it's not a care in the world. So then I came in and I said, you come out when you're ready for your bath. I came back and I'm not ready.
In other words, kids are great. Kids will work through what they're okay with, and then it's our job to find choices that we're okay with and that actually have some form of a consequence. And that's really where the tactic, right, where it does not come easy. Okay, no, was that okay for you?
For me, because
there was,
you can't get
different consequences. Right, in other words, so this is a great example. Like, so like working with her, so what happens normally after bath time? Now they get into, she gets into her clean pajamas, and then she gets a book.
Snacks.
So in other words, it's in the matter of snacks are given out to children in clean pajamas. period, end of statement. Like, just a statement. Snacks are given to, if that's the general routine, and she knows, I'm assuming she likes her snack after a bath, snacks are given to children. The new rule in the house, snacks are given to children in clean pajamas. And you don't even need to state that you need to take a bath. She knows that part already. Just snacks are given to kids, and you're done. You're totally done. You don't have to discuss it with her again. You don't have to mention anything. And if bedtime rolls around and she's still in her underwear or in her pajamas or never, are you okay putting her to bed for a night in her... And like, she's going to want the snack, I imagine, right? So she would actually rather... She doesn't want to go to bed in whatever clothing she's wearing right. Because she actually wants to take a bath now. Like, oh, I'm sorry. It's too late for... I tried giving you a bath 15 minutes ago. We're done with bath time now. Tomorrow, I'm sure you'll be able to take a bath. And then she's going to yell and scream. You're going to have to deal with that for a night. You will have to deal with that for a night. But you won't have to deal with bath time tomorrow night because she missed her snack. So it's just always trying to be creative. What else can happen naturally as a result of this? Snacks are given after bath time. So until you're in clean pajamas, there are no snacks in the house.
If we put her to bed and she's only screaming, she'll get out of bed and find us wherever we are in the house.
So then you go into the bedtime routine of a child that gets out of their bed, which is a couple of nights of along that type of, you know, just, it's, for those who have experienced it, it's just, I don't have a better routine if you don't believe in locking your children in your room, which I don't personally, but sometimes it might have to come to that.
As long as you don't have a neighbor that
calls me back. It's simply a matter of every time they come out, it's picking them up without saying anything and bringing them back. And it's literally, it might take an, you have to like dedicate, like this is what it's going to take for a night or two.
So cute and adorable.
Yeah, no, it's, don't let them think they're cute and adorable then, right? At this, it's just silent.
I always do it.
It's just no.
Yeah.
Like,
okay, you're going to go sit in the car and read another
story. Oh, yeah, I'm gone for 20 minutes. Sit again.
It's none of that. It's literally when they come out, it's not even, not, you know, it's just no words. It's,
you don't get a snack.
Not even looking.
Yeah. Looking back. Let's, for example, how do we deal with a kid who you have trouble having them wash their hands after they go to the bathroom? Classic problem. Most children, as they go through their potty training stages, will love to run out of the bathroom and continuously forget. How do you handle that one?
Tell them that.
Right, so you can lecture them and explain to them the germs on the hand.
Right.
Or what's a better way? What's the natural consequence of a child who doesn't wash their hands?
Can't
eat anything. Right? There is no more food. It's a simple rule. You can't, you come out of the bathroom. I'm not going to fight with you to drag you back into the bathroom and force you over the sink. It's going to make my life really miserable if we get into this this fight about getting you to wash your hands. I'm not going to do it. But you know what? I'm not giving you any food because it wouldn't be healthy for me to give you food. So I'll give food to children who wash their hands. End of story, you're done. You won't have a child washing their hands. Now, if you can, I would almost say it's better you can't even play with toys. I can't even let you play with your toys. It's harder to control. So if you don't think you're going to be able to control it, it's not worth doing that one. It's easier to control the food. You always have to say statements which are enforceable. So if you don't feel like you can enforce your children playing with their toys, which is harder, then I wouldn't go there. But if you feel like you can, then I wouldn't even start there. So you're welcome to come. I'm not, but there are no, you can't touch any toys until you wash your hands. Or if you, if this looks more controllable, I'm not giving you any food until you wash your hands, and you'll have a child who's washing their hands so they're cooking without a struggle. Yeah.
Feedback on what
happened.
One of, you know, the, some of the stuff went pretty smoothly, like, you know, brushing teeth, and then the next day there was no bruises. But the interesting thing for me is I actually shifted to a place of empathy.
Good.
And you know, I was like, oh yeah, you can get them. First, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do. And then I thought she was sad. She really wanted to go to Brewster's, and you know, and I said, I'm really sorry. You know, I said, I'm really sorry. I wanted you to be able to go. But I'm not quite sure how I made that shift, but when I did it, I felt like I was talking to a friend where I'm not responsible for their choices.
Excellent. They are.
And
beautiful.
They are, yeah.
It always told me last week, the hardest part for me personally is shifting that. I'm very punitive. Now you're going to get it, and you're going to learn this lesson. And if you ever are finding this is not working at all, but check that first. Like, what? How am I dealing with that? And usually I find myself in a very, you know, vindictive or angry, administering the natural consequence in a very punitive kind of way. And it usually doesn't work because the children hear that as a punishment, even though when you are really sorry and you really are on their side, I want you to be able to do this. I want to do these things for you, but I can't because I can't give you ice cream if you can't brush your teeth, or I can't give you food if you don't wash your hands. then it works because they see you on their side as opposed to against them, and there's always that rebellion. We always rebel against, like to this day we rebel against our parents, right? Whatever they say we don't want to do. It's still, that's how it works. There's that natural relationship between child and parent, and the more that we impose on them, the more that they push back. The more that we could be on their side and let the consequences that we're creating during the teaching, the better off that we are. So let me just talk about one other scenario, because I found this one personally to be extremely difficult, even with this. I was just throwing it out there. The leaving the park scene. Because now as the summer is coming, you head to the park in the afternoon. It's now 6 o'clock. Children are pretty much finished. Time to get home for supper. And they don't want to leave. And you're dreading that moment of, how am I going to get this child or children into the car without creating a massive scene? So let's just sort of work that one out. How does that look? Okay, well, so the first thing that I'm a huge believer in general is a warning as far as timing goes. That's the first thing is, you know, none of us, whenever we're doing anything, likes the plug to suddenly be pulled. So children don't like that either. 5 more minutes and we're going. 2 more minutes and we're going. Okay, now the moment has come. You've given the appropriate warning. Now it's time to go. And guess who's not following after you? Or running off of the swing set or jumping off of the... So yeah, what happens now? So my first comment from experiencing these things are what I like to call the kiddish phenomena. I'm sure all of you have experienced this where, you know, you're with your spouse at kiddish and it's time to go. And so you play this dance where one of you is ready and sort of waiting and the other one is talking. So now while you're just sitting there waiting, so you're just wasting time, so what do? So you start talking to somebody. Now your spouse looks over and sees you talking to somebody and says, oh, we're not ready to go yet, because they're talking to somebody, so they continue talking. And your spouse sees you continue talking and says, well, I might as well keep up this conversation because I got nothing doing. And you both are, you're sort of doing this dance. One of you is much more frustrated than the other, because one of you is only talking to pass the time and the other one's actually engaged in the conversation, but neither one of you are going because you both still think that the other one is there. So I have noticed that children are sort of the same way. When we say time to go, and they look at you, and you're still standing there, like watching them. They say, no, it's time to go, and they're like looking to go, okay, well, apparently not, because we're still standing here. And then, but we expect them, as a 4-year-old, to immediately jump off their swing set and come running to us like this lovely little perfect angelic child, and then we'll walk hand in hand together to our car because our child listens to our every word. So I generally find that it hasn't worked for me personally. Maybe you have had that experience, and that's great if you have such a child. But the first thing that I have actually found, if you have gone through this in other aspects, so they know when it's time to go, it means it's time to go. It's 5 minutes we're leaving, 2 minutes we're leaving, it's time to go. Actually turn and walk towards the car. And I have actually found, personally, they will regularly take, you know, it's just like us when we sometimes say, I'm done with something, just taking a couple minutes to finish up, and then I'm ready to go. Within a couple of seconds, well before I've gotten out of, eyesight from wherever however the parking is to the car, they come running behind because you mean business. It's time to go. I'm not sitting here saying, time to go, time to go. The more you stand there and repeat yourself, that goes back to what we spoke about, they don't know when you're really serious because you've just stood there for 10 minutes saying, no, it's really time to go.
You put yourself in a dangerous position.
Great, now let's talk about it because they don't follow, right? Excellent, now it happens. That's perfect. That's what I was hoping for. Anyways, what most of the time will happen, what has happened is if you've already established in general that when you speak, you mean what you say, you've given them appropriate warning, time to go, you say very calmly, okay, we're leaving now, and not as a threat or you just pick up and go, generally I've found that they will follow. Now what happens when they don't?
So I've done this before with Kayla. I mean, again, she's 2, but she'll turn to me and go, okay, bye-bye, Mommy. Mm-hmm. And she's just happy to just stay by herself.
Okay, great. So now we have a child who doesn't care that you're going. And they're staying. So we can talk about it in 2 ways and see if we could figure this out. Again, I don't want to present myself as like an expert that could figure this all out. Let's work it through. We have 2 possibilities. We have the 2-year-old who just doesn't care. That's fine. Go right ahead, Mom. Have a great time. Pick me up in the morning. I'll be ready for breakfast kind of child. And then you have the defiant 4 to 5-year-old who's really testing those limits. Like, you're not going to leave me here. I know that you're on your way out, but I'm not really interested in following. I wonder what's going to happen now, kind of child. Right? So those are the two options as to what's going to happen if, despite the fact that you've done everything right, you've given them a warning, you've started walking away, they're not following. How exactly do we handle that one? So the younger child, which I think would be easier, would be simply a matter of giving them two options. Would you like to me to carry you to the car, or would you like to walk to the car? Because if she's not at that age where she's really in that defined testing the limits, she's just really not, if she's doing her own thing. So those are the two options. And if she's gonna, if she doesn't choose to walk with you, that means she's choosing to be carried. And then it's just a matter of being confident enough that you're doing the right thing, even though you're going to have a screaming child in your arm as you walk out of the park, that's her choice. The options are not to stay here or to come with me. So you never, when you hear parents say that, you know that they're in big trouble in the park. You can either stay with me or come. Like that, or stay here or you come with me. Like, no parents really abandon their child. At least not in a public place like that. So, those are not options that are enforceable, and, it doesn't work. But the options are, you're coming with me.
But isn't that what you basically said when you say, okay, we're leaving in 5 minutes, we're leaving in 2 minutes, okay, I'm going now, and you turn around and you start walking away to see if she's going to follow. You basically said, I'm leaving, you can either stay, you either follow me or you're staying. I mean, that's
okay, so if at that age where she's not old enough to really follow, I mean, it could be that bad example of just turning and going, she's uh-huh. probably a little bit too young for that.
Right.
Because that's already a little older child, and they'll understand that I need the time to go, I want to go with you, but I'm just testing the limits how long I can stay.
Okay, so
probably with her be better, as we're just talking about, to start with, it's time to go now. Would you like me to carry you? Would you want to walk by yourself? I would probably at that age. And you have to know, this is where you have to know your own children. It could be that certain children, even as they get older, they still need that. As opposed, and then it's a matter of 5 minutes, 2 minutes, it's time to go now. Do you want to walk or do you want me to carry you? And then they're welcome to walk. And then as soon as you get resistance, it's not without a word. It's just picking you up and carrying. Most children like to go. There's always that fight for independence. And you've given them the choice, they didn't want it, and that's probably at that age what I would start with. But the more difficult case is when you have that child that's really testing the limits. And now you've walked to the car, you've waited the appropriate amount of time, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, whatever it is, and your child is playing, knows the rules, and hasn't come. At that point, this is where we're going to have to be creative. We're going to have to go back and physically pick up the child without any more options. Because as you said, once you presented that, you can't then go back and offer choice. It's over. I'm leaving. You're old enough to know the rules of the game. You didn't come. And that point is a matter of going back and I'm not picking up the child. And then it's going to be where the creative, what's the consequence of the fact that now I have to schlep all the way back and get you, bring you into the car and carry you. And you really, that's why these scenes are more difficult. Let's work that through. Now what do we do? So you have to go back, and we have to pick up the child. Now this is assuming where you didn't have to then run around after the park, right? In other words, that's already been easier. Let's say now the child takes off. Right? Now the child takes off. So the response to that is eventually, and this is what's in the back of your mind, well, we're not going to the park. And there's a natural consequence. If I can't know that we're getting back in the car at the end of the day, I can't possibly take you to the park. So we have an acute problem of getting our child into the car, but the consequences become clear in all of these circumstances of, well, child clearly likes being in the park. Guess where the child's not going tomorrow, even though we're going to figure out a way where they know that that's what we would otherwise be doing, but we can't do it. So just like the brushing the teeth, the consequence happens tomorrow with the sweets. The consequence will be, we are not going back into the park. When you prove to me that you can come to the car when it's time, we'll go back to the park.
So they prove that, so you take
a measure. So then you can, or you can do with another example, like with carpal energy. When you show me that when you can listen, there, and that's where we need to be creative. We need to come up with examples. Otherwise, what you're basically saying is, we just had this wonderful experience in the park, but I can't do this again because I don't know that you're going to be coming back with me to the car. And I can't really run after you in the park. It's too difficult for me to do. I don't want to have to deal with that. We can't go back until we can work this out. And then we have to deal with the acute problem of actually getting the kid in. But that's, sometimes you have to run around, sometimes you literally pick up the kid. I often, at that point, where it happens in the house all the time, of getting to bed, I'm really sorry that this is how you decided to do this, because you, and I'll state it at the time, you've shown me that we can't come back to the park anymore. I'm so sad. And if you could get into the empathy, where it's so sad. I love coming to the park with you. It's so sad that we can't come back because, you know, you want to say forever. You don't want to go there. That we can't go back tomorrow, or we can't go back until you can show me that you know how to get into the car when we're done. So that's really the leverage that you have is we can't do this again.
Russell, how do we make this? I'm looking at this down the road. Like, how do you make this equitable for all the children? Like, presumably, if you have more than one child, mm-hmm. there's only one child who's not cooperating, and now because of that child, you can't go back to the park tomorrow. But all the other kids are saying to you, "But we all got into the car and."
Oh yeah. So this is where you need to. That is 100% true. And then you need to figure out a way in which you have something for that child. In other words, meaning where in the book, in the author's ideal world, and they are like love, they're like to the extreme level logic. What they would tell you is as follows, and we'll adapt it to our own real lives. They would tell you hire a babysitter for that child, and then that child pays for the babysitter. How did the child pay for the babysitter? So if you're not giving allowances in front of a five-year-old child, it's a matter of, well, for the next four times that everybody gets ice cream, guess who's not getting ice cream because the money that the money that I would have otherwise spent, I would have loved to spend this money on you, but I can't because I needed to hire a babysitter because you couldn't come to the park. That's the extreme.
Now I know you've used this.
I did this once recently, but I figured it's not nice to say anything that I wouldn't try on my own children.
How did it work?
So it worked out fairly interesting. We had an event. We went to the Autism Walk. This was a week ago on Sunday, whatever it was, Autism Walk, and my 7 didn't want to go. And this was a family plan. This is what we were doing, and we're all going downtown for an hour and a half. And you know what? I also, this wasn't the first thing that I wanted to do on myself. This is what we're doing as a family. And puts up a whole, you know, little fit as 7-year-olds are able to do. He's not going, I said, fine, no problem. I called up. I have a neighbor, a babysitter for us regularly. And I said, Benjamin, I'm happy to get you a babysitter, but you're going to be responsible for paying. You'd like me to get a babysitter? Do you want to come with us? I don't want to come. No problem. Call the babysitter. I said, you're available to come. And she was. And he stayed home with her. No television, no videos, no computer. You're home with a babysitter. And he's now, I think he's done 1 out of 4. The way that we did it is we didn't say no ice cream. You can only get like the smallest size. And then what we normally would get him comes out of the pot that we had to spend on the babysitting, which was he knew up front was the deal. You don't want to come, so your choice, and you're going to pay for it because I'm not paying for the babysitter because you don't want to come downtown.
And when you do this, you told him how he's going to have to pay for it before?
No.
Okay.
So you're gonna have to pay for it somehow. And then we came home, we said, Benjamin, how would you like to pay for it? And and this is the next step. We said, how would you like to pay for the $10 of the babysitting?
And you let them be a part of trying to figure out.
Oh, 100%. So he has a couple of dollars that he's gotten from his grandparents. So you could either pay me $10 or it can come out of things that we otherwise would have bought you. You know, it's summertime, we're at the ice cream store QT once a day. Or it'll come out like that. How would you like to do it? So I thought about it, and he said, I'll do it with the ice cream. Said, no problem. So for the next 5 trips, he's going to get a size smaller than everybody else's. Younger siblings are going to get more ice cream than him because he's paying off the babysitter that we had to get because he didn't want to go. But you know what? There was no fighting in this house. I was not going to drag a 7-year-old into the car and then drag him around for an hour and a half downtown. Now, it's a little bit harsh and extreme. But you know, there was no fight. There was no battle. And he tried pulling it again a day or so ago, and I said, that's not an option now because you haven't yet paid up the previous one. You finished paying off first babysitter, you do the second time. This time it's not an option, you have to come with us. And he knew he was still paying it off, so he didn't put up a fight for this other trip. But it's a harsh, it's a nidus ha-din, it's judgment, it's very, and I always, as you know, I like when I share the thoughts, and I always, when I recommend the book, always to say, this is really, it's harsh to an extent. You have to really lock in the empathy, and any couple, any one of you who implement it on any level, need to find your comfort zone for how far you're willing to take such a situation. But that is how they would handle that situation. They would say, you know, I have other children who do want to go to the park, So if you have a neighbor who can watch the child, you have somebody you could work out with for free, and then it's great. And I would leave the child back, even if it's not a miserable experience for the child. He gets to play with a friend, but he's not going to the park.
You take him in, like, either, I mean, assuming that your car is next to you at the park type of thing, like, make him wait in the car while he ever gets to play?
Any of those things. In other words, 100%. Whatever works for you.
Gosh.
In other words, whatever works.
You think that's harsher than making him pay for his ice cream and his babysitter?
You need to find, this is where it's creative, and every couple needs to find what works. Whether or not you have a grandparent in town who could watch the child, or you have a friend who could take him. But yes, in other words, the other children shouldn't suffer, and it's upon you to be creative. And this is what, in other words, what we're changing is the parenting energy from being frustrated with arguing with your four-year-old into being creative, into thinking of ways that it makes sense that. That's fine. If I struggled with you at the park, you can't come back with me next time. I wish you could, and you have to lock that empathy, and I really wish you could. You can't. You have decided that you can't for now. And I will find another thing for you to do while you're still... it could be a matter of... you do it on a Sunday when Darren's home. Darren stays home with him, and it's Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning, and you plan this in advance. Let's go to the park. And everybody gets ready, and... Oh yeah, Daddy's staying home anyway to do work. You'll just stay home with Daddy. And it's not a discussion, it's not a debate, it's just a fact. Daddy's staying home anyway, it just happens to have been that way. Mom is going to the park, and Jordan's home with Daddy. And Dad's not playing with him, obviously, having a grand old time. Dad's doing work. Sometimes you need to delay it. So if you have to wait until Sunday or later in the afternoon, you come home from work, and even if it's like 20 minutes, it's really dinner. You just need to be creative to find ways that he can stay home and everybody else goes.
I've got a question of, like, the next level of follow-through for this and for the Brewsters. So, like, with our son, if we did something like that, he'd be like, okay, stay at home, let's wreck the house, let's do this, let's distract Daddy, let's, you know what I mean? So he would just pull and suck in all the energy.
100%. And then
that's one thing. And then for the Brewsters, like, for my daughter, I could just picture her negotiating with my son so that she gets his ice cream in exchange for, I don't know what, you know what I mean? So then it's like the next step.
We're obviously not going to address that. That's where you need to be creative and find out what works. But there's a theory, there's a practice. You just keep bumping up what they want to play. So if he wants to be disruptive in the house, so then whatever the natural consequences for a child who's disruptive in the house, and you'll find each time the new situation happens, you'll be at a loss. How do I handle this? And then you put it in your registry. Oh, this is what we do when the house is destroyed. We can't do X, Y, or Z until you clean up the house, whatever it may be. And then as soon as it happens and you've experienced it and you've thought about it and you've come to something, you'll now have that in your repertoire. And then you just continuously respond to whatever they want to throw at
you. What about the ice cream? And you say, well, that's not, you know what I'm saying? It's a sort of,
okay, now that's a separate question. I wanted to ask Dr. Aaron Feldman that question, not related to this, where it just was I was finding my older children were manipulating the younger children with these sweet deals that they were making. And so it's like, you fell for that one? How did you go there? So I remember asking, like, should I step in and, negotiate on behalf of the younger siblings? So another person was like, don't worry about it. The younger siblings grow up, and when younger siblings grow up, they'll fend for themselves. And right now, the fact that they lost a little bit of ice cream, it's fine. You want to buy them a second treat. You don't have to, like, meddle. Now, here is a different situation where you're specifically trying to let the older child. So, I could hear stepping in trying to protect the rights of the younger sibling that they don't lose.
Just about the rights of the younger siblings. If you have a child, and let's say you take the scenario, he's taking back, he's playing forever, he doesn't want to come off the game. So, you don't get your book done, fine.
Right.
You just lost your book done. Great. But then, he starts raving and ranting, and he's not allowing other children to go to sleep because of his behavior. And so the other children will suffer because of the consequences that he's experiencing. So therefore, how do you prevent others from suffering?
Do your children like sleeping in your bed?
Yeah. Well, not this one.
No, not the one, but for the other ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So when that happens to one of our children, so all the other children get to sleep in our bed that night. Mm. And that little child left by himself in his room. And all the other ones are in our bed. That doesn't work for you because... No, but they end up saying they're not going to fall asleep. So in other words, they just fall asleep in the bed. They're out, but they're transferred. There's no sleeping at night. So that kid now loses out. Now again, that's what's worked for us because we have this. That fell as a problem of dealing with that exact problem. How do I handle one kid who's causing a problem and keeping the other ones awake? Well, I need to separate this one child. Well, I have nowhere to put that troublemaking child in a way that I'm not going to banish him to the basement just yet because my wife won't let me, but I'm ready to do that.
Yes.
So now that that's not an option, the only option are sort of rewarding the other ones that, well, they can't be around you because you're disturbing them. What do I do with them? They can't be around you. Well, there's only other place to put them is in our room. So they'll fall asleep in our room tonight, which that child really wants to do, but they're by themselves. Because everybody else can't be around them. Now, if that doesn't work in your favor, you have a policy, the children don't fall, that's fine. This is where every family, every home, just create a way of working around that.
So, I'm assuming it's not ideal to play off the other child and say, oh, this one is being so good there.
Yeah. Avoid that. We'll talk about it in the next 2 weeks, siblings, how to handle it, but yeah, for sure.
A lot of this is trying to figure out ways to kind of get around and get the kid to do something, kind of bribery. If you don't do this, then you can't get that. And then you always end up dealing with some of these problems that ensue from that.
Like, who's doing that?
No, I'm saying, like, in general, the way you try to, in this whole philosophy, is saying, well, if you're not going to cooperate, then now you can't get this as a consequence. Well, whatever happened to saying, like, I'm the Ima, I'm the Abba, this is what you say, this is what you do.
That's the way you should say it. In other words, the first way you said that, was actually a threat couched in terms of a consequence. But when you said it that was actually a threat. If you're not going to do this, so you want to state it as I'm the Ima, children are supposed to get in their car seats on time. Or, you know, we need to brush our teeth, you need to wash your hands. I am stating the policy of the home and then let them rebel against that and then deal with what happens as a result. Don't say it as a threat. If you don't brush, I don't want to say my child while I'm in the bathroom, if you don't brush your teeth, you're not going to get a snack tomorrow. Because then I just get into the whole threat routine and then I'm going to follow. I'm not fighting with you. It's time to brush your teeth. I'll wait here for a minute for you. And if you don't want to, that's great. You'll find out tomorrow that it really didn't work out so well for you. So I'm going to try to avoid threatening them
or
bribing them using the words of if you don't, but it's really just a threat. And so it ended the same thing.
So we tell her it's time to brush her teeth. If she doesn't, do we then tell her what the consequence was?
No. Tomorrow you do that.
It's more about being done. Like,
yeah. It's fine. I'm interested. Not a problem. It's not my problem. Again. Not a problem. Let her think I won.
And then tomorrow say, do you remember how you didn't brush your teeth?
No. Tomorrow when she doesn't get a snack, or she asks for one, either it's not in her lunch, or when she comes home from school and she usually gets ice cream and she asks for it and you don't give it to her, oh, I'm so sorry. I'd love to give you ice cream, but I can't give ice cream to girls who don't brush their teeth tonight because I'm so afraid of cavities.
Or it doesn't have to be that far away. If she doesn't brush her teeth, oh, I'm sorry, I can't read you a book now.
No. That's a punishment. That's not a natural consequence. Unless you set it up. Now, there's a slight variation. You can set it up, for example, that we said earlier, children in clean pajamas get snacks. You can set it up. This is a nighttime routine. You do what you want. I read books. If you set it up where it's not a punishment of this unrelated thing of you did X and now Y comes down from the sky, that you always want to avoid. If you want to set it up as a natural, this is the order of the evening. The order is bath, pajamas, books. I will read books when we've gone through the order, then that's a different story. But
if tea comes into that order and they don't brush the tea, then you could use it because you could say, it took so long and you didn't actually get through the order and now there's no time left.
Right, but then there's no time left. Very careful the way that you do it. I want to read you a book. I don't have time versus a punishment of, yeah, sure, there's time to read books, but I'm angry at you. I'm not reading you a book. It's got to be with the consequence of, this took so much energy to finish this. There's no more time. It's got to be that nuance. It's a slight, but the child has to hear you're on their side, you would love to read them a book, but you can't because of their decision, as opposed to you being the authoritative punisher, which won't get you.
So what happens when they're 12 and they kind of realize that you could, if you wanted to...
It's the same exact story. It is the same. And it becomes where mom and dad have their own lives, and they're busy with stuff. And everything just gets bumped up as the children get older, to whatever age that they are. But let me use that as a segue, because I wanted to make sure we at least got to the next phase. The part that we've been discussing is really the much more difficult part, in which we're creating the limits and the rules around the house, or society, brushing teeth, washing your hands after the bathroom, and then how we handle the children when they don't abide by those limits. There's another aspect of this which is really very much the same, but it's where life itself creates the consequence that the child has to exist in. Meaning, it's not that they're not listening to our rules, something happened. For example, my four-year-old, we're at a birthday party. We're leaving the birthday party. Leaving the birthday party with the family is never an easy task. Gather everybody together. Gather everybody's stuff. You make your way to your car, which is parked around the other end. And right as you get to the car, your four-year-old says, "Oh, I forgot my goodie bag," and starts crying. Now we have a problem, because I just got the whole family from there to over here. Let's just say I'm by myself. Now what? So the child breaks down and finally wants a goodie bag. So here's the classic situation in which we're going to apply the exact same principle, in which we're on the child's side, but whose problem is this if the child forgot the goodie bag? Not our problem. It's the child's problem. We have to be big enough to allow the child to learn the consequences of forgetting the goodie bag. Not my problem as a child. So what we often would do is, we say, "Oh, I can't believe you forgot," and we, the whole way, muttering under our breath, yelling at the child, "Don't forget it again, I told you, I warned you, I reminded you." We'll schlep all the way back, get the goodie bag, and really nothing has been accomplished other than the fact that we are real frustrated by the time that we get back to the car after schlepping everybody back. Or, we sit there on the curb, and we utter the most magical words that you will, when I first heard these, was just screaming, saying, "Oh no, what should we do about that?" Not my problem, the child's problem. Well, now I have a four-year-old on the curb, who's now faced with his problem of, well, great question, what are we going to do about that? So he's going to say,
"You can go back and get it for me."
100%, of course that's what he's going to say. Right? Any smart child worth keeping is going to say, "Go back and get it." And what do we say? "Oh, I'm so sorry. I wish I could. I just got everybody here. We got to get back home. I don't have time to do that right now. I can't." Now what should we do? Well, and that's basically, well, so in other words, what I would present the two options would be, if, now at birthday party this one works, would be, you can go back and get it. I'm going to stay here with your kids while I load them up. You can go get it. Or we'll just forget it. I'm so sorry that we didn't have it. What would you like to do? Because in other words, the child, you can provide the options. But he can go back and get it, which is in this, by birthday party, if you're not parked, you're probably fine. Or, "I'm sorry, I can't go back. I'm going to load up the children. I'm going to start loading them up. You just tell me what you want to do." And now your four-year-old makes the decision what works. Now again, that scenario has to be one where it's obviously safe for the child to go back and things work out. But this is not my problem that the child forgot the goodie bag. It's the child's problem. The child is going to figure out what they want to do with it. And the natural consequence is they begin to learn at four what happens. I have a seven-year-old who comes home with a book report due, and she forgot the instructions in school. It's now 7 o'clock at night, time to do the homework, or 6 o'clock, whatever time it is, and I forgot my instructions at school. My response: "Oh no, what are we going to do about that? Whose problem is it that she forgets?" So what a lot of parents would do is now they turn their whole night upside down, calling every teacher and every parent and every friend, like, that they are now responsible for getting the instructions for their child. I'm not responsible for getting instructions for my child. Let my child learn at 7 what happens when you forget your instructions at home, rather than at 17 or 27 the consequences of forgetting important papers at home. And your child will learn at 7 to call their friends You understand? What should we do about that? Maybe my friend has it. Can you call? I'm not calling. Here's the phone. A 7-year-old child will now learn to make that phone call and figure out how to get it. Now, there's a certain point. Again, the love and logic people, right, if you took this extreme, would say, you as a parent do nothing. You're not driving a kid anywhere. You're not doing anything. Now, and that's feasible. My children were figuring out how to use the fax machine because she was going to get a friend to fax it over because none of us were available to go out and pick it up, and she forgot and she needed it. She made the phone calls. She found a friend who had it, and she was going to have the friend have their parents who could help them out with the fax to fax it over. But it was her problem, and if she lost a grade in school, great. I would be so thrilled that at 7 years old, in a meaningless grade as a first grader, she learned that lesson, and whether or not she remembered it next time or not is totally fine. But I'm not losing my night because she forgot her paper, and she probably won't forget it again for the rest of the year. And if she does, that's also fine. She'll figure it out again the next time. One of the most stressful moments of our dinner routine is when one of the children spills something. Now, any of you who have had children know children spill stuff. They do it all the time. And it's, for some reason, at dinner time, we're at our wit's end. It's one of the most frustrating things in the world. It's a matter of learning, not a problem. The towels are in the third drawer. I'll take away the plate. When you're finished cleaning it up, I'll be happy to, give your plate back to you. But who's responsible for cleaning up the mess, as opposed to us muttering under our breaths about some instructions about, cup spilling and reading? It's not my problem to spill, but it's yours. And the same thing would go, when this is cleaned up, you'll be able to then do, and then you list whatever thing would have otherwise happened tonight that they want to do. Everything gets put on hold until the child himself is able to do it. I had, this week I got one of my Fridays, I try to take one of the kids on the errands with me, so we get to spend some time. So part of the treat is they get to buy a little something in one of the stores. So this particular child, it's a thing with a bunch of little pieces to it. So on the way home, he says, "Can I open this now?" Now, I used to always say, I try to avoid the word always, I used to say no, knowing that he's going to lose pieces in the car. So I would say, "Don't open it in the car. Wait till we get home." What does he say to that?
"I want to open it now."
"I want to open it now." And now we get into a fighting match in the car after our wonderful daddy and little boy time together running errands on Friday afternoon results in a trip back home from the store in a screaming match over whether or not he should or shouldn't open up the toy that I got him to celebrate our spending time together in the car. And I used to actually go through that because I know best that he's going to lose it in the car and then he's going to be really upset when he gets home and he doesn't have all the pieces of his puzzle or whatever it is. It's a far better response to say something along the lines of, "You can, I'm a little bit nervous you might lose a piece, but if you'd like to open it now, go right ahead." Let him open it, and guess what's going to happen? He's going to lose a piece, because that's what happens. And you know what? That's totally fine. That's not my problem, that's going to be his, and I will be very sympathetic and sorry, but very happy that he's learning that's how it goes.
And how will you remind him, "I told you so"?
I don't.
Without saying, "I told you."
Don't. You don't need to, ever. I don't need to. Now, I want to point out that Dan, and I was speaking about this just on yesterday, said something about if there's any empirical evidence whether or not this actually works in teaching children responsibility, can teachers note the difference, whether or not parents did employ this or didn't. And my response was, I really don't care whether or not it works or doesn't work teaching children responsibility. I, as a parent, am so much calmer and so much less frustrated, so that whether or not they really learn or they don't learn, I think in the end, as I mentioned last week, that my kids went to go take a bath because they wanted to play a game and they knew the only thing certain, it eventually sinks in, and eventually it does. But even if it doesn't, my day is far better. My bedtime routine is far calmer. I know how I'm going to handle it when we let one of the kids stay up later on a Friday night, and then because they've lost it, they give us a real hard time getting into bed, and I simply say, "Oh, I see this is how you decided to respond. Let me let you stay up late tonight. I got it." I don't say anything else. It's It's bedtime, there's a little battle, and it's over because, oh, this is how you decided to behave after I let you stay up. Not a problem. Mommy, did you notice this? Notice it. Great. Well, they know what's coming next week if they don't change their tune real fast. And there's no battle, there's no fight. I'm not going to run around the house chasing you. I'm not going to do that. Once you get to a certain age, that we're past that. And it's just a matter of, oh, this is how you decided to behave into these circumstances? No problem. It's noted. I got it. And they learn what comes.
I think, I don't know if you could address, I think maybe the, one of the underlying anxieties of this whole experience is, well, my kid's going to hate me. Mary Shea gets into the circus. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like,
so that will happen.
It's not like they're getting older and they're going to, you know, because I had this like cold.
So A, I have two things to say to that. A, if you're not good at locking in the empathy and the sympathy and you're really doing it in a very punitive way, then you will be seen as very punitive and punishing. If you can get into the side of the child of, I really generally want you to do these things, I want to be able to give them to you, but I can't. Now the other thing that I want to say is, if you remember, I broke this into within 2 weeks of Love and Logic and 2 weeks of other stuff, which will start next week. And the reason for that is because I share that this is a little bit of a harsh judge type method of response, behavior, response. Behavior, response, and you're going to, I don't like this as a whole approach because I find it harsh. What we're going to do for the next 2 weeks is, in terms of developing a loving relationship, how to speak to your child. When you have a solid foundation, and generally your children know that they're a gift, they really walk around and you speak to them regularly, and you ask them, what's the greatest gift that Hashem ever gave me? And they know it's them. When you have that, and then they misbehave on a late Friday night, and you say something like that, you're on solid ground. And that fear, if that's your only relation, if all of your dialogues with your child or children are, you do this, well, you know, bam, consequence. Then, yeah, I have that same fear, and I would speak to a professional. But when it's tempered with the other stuff, the other way that we speak to our children, when they're not spilling things at the dinner table, then it's much less. And I'd also just add that, again, I'm every couple or family, as you hear this, you'll find the level that you're really comfortable with as far as, you know, how far does it go? Like, for example, a child forgets something at school. This is a classic example that we'll speak about. Your child forgot their lunch or a report. Now you're dealing with a third grader, fourth grader, fifth grader. They call you up, I forgot my paper at home. I'm going to get a 10 points off of the grade of it. So pure love and logicists would say, right, you lock right in the empathy and you say, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. I hate when I do that. It's terrible. What's going to happen to you? 10 points. Ah, that's the worst. What are we going to do about this? And they'll say, well, you're going to bring it to me. And you're going to say something along the lines of, oh my goodness, I wish I could. I have a meeting. I have to run. I can't do it. I hope it works out for you. And you hang up really fast before you give in. Now that would be the approach of, what a great lesson for a fourth grader to learn, that before you leave when a report's due, you check your bag. That's what you do, that's what responsible adults do, right? We always double check when we have a presentation to make, that we have everything that we need. How do we know to do that? Because we've learned the hard way. We can either learn the hard way when it really costs us money, or we can learn the hard way when it costs us 10 points on a third graded paper. Now, whether or not you're comfortable doing that, you know, you really need to find your comfort zone as to whether or not you're going to say, you know, this is not where I'm going to institute this theory. I'm just, you know, my child's going to know that I'm there for them. And when my child calls me and says that they need something, they know that they can rely on me, I'm going to be there. That example of your child forgetting a paper is the classic machlokas, the dispute in parenting theory. How do you handle that? Do you handle it in a way of, my child will know that I'm always there for them when they need me, they call me, I'll drop everything for them? Or do you let them learn, I love them, I feel so bad, if you can really do it, when you really feel bad, but they're going to learn on a very low cost, and you really need to find where you're comfortable with. I'm not going to present that, you know, you need to find, and whether or not on this, you know, if kids forget their lunch, you know, I'm not willing to teach, it's not worth it for me to teach my 5-year-old about forgetting the lunch, that I'm not going to drop, I'll drop off the lunch at school. But, you know, if he forgets his baseball glove, I'm not going back for that. If he has, you know, on Sunday afternoons he plays baseball and he runs out, you know, because I'm oh, we're leaving now, I'm not waiting for him, time to leave, and he runs out, and he forgot his glove, and I drop him off, and I get a call from the, you know, the coach's cell phone, you know, the gentleman forgot his baseball glove. I'm sorry. Like, I'm not going back out to bring his baseball. That I'm willing for him to learn. You want to play baseball, bring your glove. You want to eat, bring your lunch. I'm not willing. You know, there, I'm going to do that. I'm going to go back and bring your lunch. You need to just find your comfort zone.
Shoes.
You know, the purist would say no, and the realist in mean life experience, that our children will give us so many thousands of opportunities to work this through. That, you know, I understand my personal, like, you know, if there was a real love and logic person here who'd be listening to this recording would say, absolutely not. If you're going to do it, you got to do it for real and you got to do it consistently. And
but you can still do it because you could say, well, I was about to go do this.
Right.
And now I'm going to have to do this. And then later in the day,
because
oh,
of the
I wanted to
minute.
Give you this, but I
right.
have to do what I had to do before.
Right. See, Marx is a real student. Marx is already pointing out that you could accomplish both and you could somehow fit in. And just come up with some other response. That's the Lord. Like, what happened? Because I needed to spend the extra 15 minutes out of my day doing this, the whole day was 15 minutes off, and therefore, and you can do that also.
Don't let the kids starve, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a purist would. Now, I read in the books, in his book, without question, the authors of this theory would, without question, would say, you've forgotten your lunch, very sorry. I'm really not. I can't even do it because for the real empathy, which I can't even pretend to have in this situation, would say, I'm so sorry, there's just no lunch. And that's how it goes. That's the purest.
I don't know how the other couples have found this, but I found just in this week that not only does it pull the anger out of us and I think I'm speaking for most of us in the way that we've handled Jordan, but it's also really tempered frustration that we've had with each other. Because parents, I think, like you said, one's an apple, one's an orange, we approach things differently. And, I mean, there's several times in the past 4 years that we've watched the way the other one is handling a situation and not agreed with it, and either in like fuming inside or actually like at the moment given the child mixed signals. I mean, we're not really doing that, I don't think, as much this week as we have.
We both agree that this seems to work.
So right, so we're trying
to consistent approach between both of us.
Right.
Whereas before, I think we both have our own methods and neither one of us, or sometimes one or the other doesn't agree with the other one's method.
But I've actually found that it's not only taken the anger out towards the child, but it's taken the frustration out in our, as a couple, in our parenting of the child.
Yeah. Anybody else? Well, because you feel like you're using a unified method instead of each of you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A method. Something. But that's huge, and that's my same point that I said about the empirical evidence. I could care less if it actually works in teaching responsibility. I do think it does. But it's an approach that both of us know when any one of us here, the other one kicking to that mode, just backing it up, and you're not going to sneak the candy under the table. Like, that's the deal. I poured you chocolate milk and you spilled. I'm so sorry. Tomorrow you can get another glass of chocolate milk, but I only give out one a day. And you'll be more careful. Now, a three-year-old that might not work with, but a five-year-old that will once they're able to know. Notice, like, when you see that cup at the edge of the table, like, you have a couple of options when the cup's at the edge of the table. What are our options? We can move it, in which we impose our parental guidance and our love for the child. We don't want them to spill the chocolate milk. We can move it into the middle of the table. We can demand of our children to move it into the middle of the table. How well would that go? That's not going to work. Or we could suggest cups at the end of the table, at the edge of the table, often spill. Nothing more needs to be said. If it doesn't spill, great. When it does, I gave you chocolate milk already, and so tomorrow there'll be more chocolate milk. It's a lot less frustrating. And guess who's cleaning up that chocolate milk, by the way? And it's not me. There are the towels. And you know, often, because you want your kitchen clean, you'll have to go back over it anyway. But at least the practice of somebody cleaning it up I've often found, I want to share this also, when a child spills, which is, again, standard behavior for a child, when we react the way that we are prone to do, which is with tremendous frustration, the impression we give to the child is that they are incapable. This is this horrible tragedy that there are now Cheerios all over the floor. If you've ever, we sometimes actually give that impression, that there is like a tragedy which is taking place in our kitchen because there are Cheerios all over the floor. And you can see it in their faces, the sense of failure that the child has because they spilled their bowl of Cheerios. As opposed to letting them, no problem, mistakes happen, spills happen, here's the mop, here are the towels, let me know if you need any help. The sense of accomplishment that the child has of, okay, I spilled, I learned from my parents, that's okay. That kind of stuff happens. As opposed to, and I remember the sense that I would get when we would, before trying to do this with our children, like feeling so guilty, like I could see at how uneasy I just made my child because my three-year-old spilled Cheerios. That's what children do. And we want to let them know that that's okay. Children spill. They make mistakes. And our response is always, no problem. No sweat. Here's how you fix it.
I have a question in the context of potty training. My 2.5-year-old has decided that, because I'm always just like that, it's okay, no problem.
Something spills. She goes,
uh-oh.
It's okay. She tells us it's okay.
It's okay.
It's okay.
But it's not just a potty training. What she's starting to do is that she, you know, makes pee-pee in her underwear. She'll just take it off, put it in the hamper, and go get it clean there. And tell me that it's okay. Now, on the one hand, I find this to be tremendous progress because she goes and does it all by herself. On the other hand, we still have consistently wet underwear, and we're really not making any progress at all, and that no, this is actually not okay.
Great question. You know, we'd have to be coming up with something, which I'm blanking right now on the spot, as to what would be a natural consequence of the fact that she's, you know, having to change.
Has to wear pull-ups.
Pull-ups or
that? Yeah. That won't work.
If you really want to be, why don't you wear underwear?
Because is that more uncomfortable for her?
If she wet your bed?
In her underwear.
Yeah, of course.
So put one of those plastic sheets, you know, the plastic things under the sheet, put in an old sheet on the bed.
She's not what?
Put in her underwear. It probably is. But no, but she clearly is potty trained.
She is.
Exactly. She's not asleep.
She wants to drink.
She doesn't want to get up. Right.
She's already asleep.
She knows that she's
cognizant of what she's doing.
Yeah, but once they're actually like going to sleep, even though in the beginning before they fall asleep, they might go to the bathroom. One of the things, they might not be ready.
Right, I'm saying this case seems to be where they're not. She's not asleep. I mean, I
so, yeah. Just leave her at
Okay, what's that?
How does she feel about diapers?
She wears diapers. It's the same thing like a pull-up. A diaper and a pull-up are the same thing.
She's not at the stage yet where she thinks pull-ups are for big kids and
that's well, like, she'd rather a pull-up, but it's the same thing.
Okay, let us. I want to finish up with one more term from the Love and Logic people, which is for general for children as they're getting older, but it's good to be aware, and then we'll call it a night with that. Now, the term that they use is the term they call it going brain dead, which I know that Rifke very much doesn't like, but I will at least, so if you see it in writing, you'll know what it is that they're referring to. This is where you get into debates or arguments with your children. When there's a certain circumstance, let's just say your child is 6 years old and wants to have a sleepover, and the answer is no, for whatever reason it may be, you as a parent decide this is not a night for a sleepover. Now, any child that's worth keeping is not going to say, oh, okay, Mom and Dad, thank you so much for considering it. I see you in the morning. That's not the response you're going to get from your 6-year-old. You're going to get something closer along the lines of, but I really want to, but everybody else is, but you guys hate me. But you wish I wasn't born. If you really loved me, then you would let me go. Or something along those lines. Right. Something along where they get real good and real creative. And I even remember to this day the first time that we heard that phrase of, you don't love us. You don't love me. Or you wish I wasn't born. And it totally flipped us out. And we were on the phone with Aaron Feldman like within the minute. Like, I thought I just told us another. Like, and how old is she? It's like 5. Oh, she's just precocious. Most children don't say that until they're 7 or 8. That's like that.
She was not 4.
She wasn't even 4 yet. I mean, so that's the kind of stuff that. So their approach. Their approach is you simply go brain dead as far as the argument, because this is not an argument that will lead to anything productive. You cannot argue with a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, or even a teenager when the answer is decided and they're just trying to get you to give in to whatever it is that they want. So they have a couple of phrases, and just simply repeat the phrases. I know, everybody else, I know, you hate, I know, if you really love me, I know, and eventually they will get the point. So the phrases they say is, I know, it's so sad, or when you have older children, the nice try. Like my child says, if you love me, you let me do this. Nice try.
Good one.
Good one. You can make up your own one. But there's just nothing than a one-liner that's just repeated over and over and over. And humor is great with these things. And once you're at that point where the decision is made and I'm not fighting, and the last phrase that they would always encourage is, I love you too much to argue. But it's just one of those phrases of, I know. I love you. Their children are going to continue with everything they got and the kitchen sink to get you to change. Don't engage the argument because it cannot. You cannot explain it to them because they're what?
Can't negotiate
with
parents.
You can't. No negotiation. So it's just. Right, it's just, this is the deal, this is the answer, I'm not going to ignore you, I'm just going to respond as if I'm not hearing this conversation, I know, I really have a nice try, good one, I love you too much to argue, you can switch off and you go back and forth, but there's not going to be a debate in this house about this issue, it's been decided, and without using those words, that's basically what you do, and eventually they'll get frustrated, but that's just one last thing that I wanted to say. Yeah.
I've heard a lot of Sabra Maslow stuff also, and I don't want to jump ahead, but there seems to be a segue here that I just wanted to point out. My daughter had some social issues at one point where there were some girls in the class that were, of course, I'll be your friend if, blah, 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 And last summer, I was out of the house and someone was babysitting while my daughter was having a play date with one of these girls. And I called in to check on everything, and my daughter says to me, so-and-so's at the house, and she said she's not going to play with me, she's not going to be my friend unless I give her the in my room. And the thing I had read in Sabra Maslow was something about the mother setting limits with her daughter and it spilling over into the daughter's life so that she was able to set limits with other people. And what ended up happening, so this love and logic is setting those limits, and I had used this phrase, I love you too much to argue, but one of the phrases also, just in a different way, was, I followed it up with, if it's too hard for you to do X, then you can do Y. But it was no discussion about it. And so I asked her, I said, what would, she said, well, then my friend will think I'll hate her and da-da-da. And I said, do I love you? She said, yes. I said, well, what would happen if the two of us, pretend that it's the two of us? What would happen if it were mine
and you said that you wouldn't be my daughter anymore, or you wouldn't love me, and if I didn't give it to you, what would I say? And she told me, and I said, and then what would happen? Am I still your mommy? Or, you know, and she said, yeah. And I said, do I still like you? Do I still love you? Yeah. Do you think this is something you might want to try? And she did it. And then she said to her friend, you know, if it's too hard for you to be in my room and see this toy when I won't give it to you, we can play out in the living room. And her friend did it. But it was really this idea of, what? No, it's not. That's a whole other lesson. Okay. There are situations in life where you have to draw boundaries. And yep. I think acting with your own, it's like a weird thing to say that a parent has to show their own self-esteem, you know what I mean, to be able to, and I'm just saying, I think it has greater ramifications than just stopping an argument at home. It's
an example.
Yeah.
Right. 100%. And you will hear that your children will begin talking, you know, if you get, and especially some of the things we'll discuss over the next 2 weeks in terms of the general way that we interact, even which is not just in response to things that they've done wrong or out of circumstances, they will pick up the way that we speak. Just like when we react or overreact, when they spill their Cheerios and we give them the message that something horrible has just happened, when we give them, they will learn to respond in the same way that we respond to them, in much more healthy and positive ways. All right, let's call a night for that. Continue, and I'm looking forward to hearing how things went over the next week, and then we'll pick up with some of the other approaches, Mirza Hashem, next Monday night.